The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue. Our first article is going to be from Teen Vogue's OG History series, which is a series in which we unearth history not told through a white, cis-heteropatriarchal lens. It's been a while since we've seen a new OG History article, so I'm excited to get into this one. It's titled Buck v. Bell, the Supreme Court case that fueled the eugenics movement. This article is written by Bongo Thompson and was published September 21st of 2021. There was nothing wrong with Carrie Buck. Nonetheless, several well-respected men had a tremendous interest in proving that there was. Harry Laughlin, director of the Eugenics Record Office, who had never met Carrie, swore that she was an immoral, lying prostitute. Aubrey Strode, a former Virginia legislator who authored the Virginia Sterilization Act of 1924, argued in front of the Supreme Court that Carrie's reproductive capabilities needed to be taken away. Although it was of very little interest to anyone at the time, Carrie's harrowing experience in the spotlight stemmed primarily from circumstances out of her control. Carrie Buck, born in 1906, grew up as the daughter of a desperately impoverished single mother before becoming the foster child of a well-off couple. She was taken out of school after the sixth grade to work full-time cleaning the houses of well-to-do families. Carrie was raped at the age of 16 by her foster mother's nephew, becoming pregnant as a result. Her foster parents reacted viciously and had Carrie declared mentally incompetent and sent to the Virginia State Colony for epileptics and feeble-minded. The colony was created as a result of the burgeoning eugenics movement and sought to segregate those who were seen as genetically inferior so that their defects might be kept from spreading through reproduction. The American eugenics movement exploded into a political scene in the early 20th century, promising, in the words of breakfast cereal magnate and ardent eugenics John Harvey Kellogg, a new and glorified human race which sometime, far down in the future, will have so mastered the forces of nature that disease and degeneracy will have been eliminated. If the genetically inferior could be taken out of the equation, the belief went, the utopian future could be achieved. The evidentiary foundations of the eugenics movement were rather ludicrous and pseudo-scientific, but nonetheless counted Americans such as Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson among its supporters. As Andrea Den Hoed explained in The New Yorker, the colony in which Carrie found herself was not unique. Many such institutions existed to segregate the genetically undesirable. What separated Carrie from a host of women in similar situations was that the place she wound up in was run by a particularly ambitious man. Dr. Albert Pretty, the superintendent at the Virginia colony, had already succeeded in isolating perceived undesirables from the broader population. But he didn't stop there. Rather than segregating those deemed feeble-minded, his institution and others like it could simply sterilize them all. With the ability to reproduce taken away, the residents could be let back into the general population without any risk of furthering the bloodlines that threatened a superior Aryan fantasy race. Although the Virginia Sterilization Act of 1924 granted legal protections to those who performed the procedure, similar state laws had been struck down by the courts. With this in mind, Pretty opted to bring a test case to see if it could pass legal muster before any sterilizations were actually carried out. Carrie was chosen for this rather sinister undertaking because she seemed to present the strongest case about the dangers of an unregulated gene pool, according to Den Hoed. She was labeled a middle grade moron, meaning that she had a slightly below average IQ, but could theoretically pass as ordinary and breed with her genetic betters. She'd already given birth to a child who was similarly stigmatized without any evidence, thus giving the false impression that Carrie was indeed genetically inferior and capable of passing on those genes. This is how Carrie Buck found her case in front of the Supreme Court, where men argued whether or not they would allow her to have more children. Irving Whitehead, who served as Carrie's defense attorney, had been childhood friends with Aubrey Strode, who was arguing in favor of having Carrie sterilized, and formerly served on the board of the Virginia Colony. Carrie, clearly without adequate legal representation, found herself on the losing side of an 8-1 vote of the highest court in the case designated Buck v. Bell. Pretty died during the court battle, and the case took the name of his successor. Writing for the majority, Associate Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. offered a bone-chilling justification. It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their immicability, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. In a reference to Carrie's mother and daughter, Holmes opined, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough." Buck v. Bell, which remains legal precedent despite being partially repudiated in the 1942 case Skinner v. Oklahoma, gave the American eugenics movement the legal backing it needed to achieve its wildest dreams. The exact number of forced sterilizations that were performed as a result of the movement's success is unknown, but estimated to be north of 60,000. During the Nuremberg trials, a lawyer for Nazi defendants cited the case to help justify their own crimes against humanity. Justice Holmes, who was 86 at the time of this ruling, became the oldest sitting justice in the history of the Supreme Court, retiring in 1932 at the age of 90. He died with his reputation intact, 2 days shy of turning 94. His house became a national landmark in 1972, and his name adorns a middle school in Los Angeles. Carrie's family was not as lucky. As the New York Times noted in a 1980 article, Carrie's sister, Doris, was sterilized without her consent during an operation that she believed was for appendicitis. Only as a 67-year-old woman did Doris learn why she had never been able to realize her dream of having children. Carrie's daughter, Vivian, was taken from her and raised by the same foster parents who had committed Carrie after she had been raped. Vivian was declared mentally deficient by a social worker who examined her when she was just 6 months old. Explaining her diagnosis, the social worker testified, "There is a look about it that is not quite normal, but just what it is, I can't tell." Despite difficulties with math classes, Vivian did quite well in school, even earning a spot one term on the honor roll. She died from an unknown illness when she was just 8 years old. Little record exists of Carrie's life after the Supreme Court case. She was sterilized soon after and eventually released from the Virginia colony. She spent her final years hungry and freezing in a small shack before she entered a nursing home in the early 80s, according to a paper in The Catholic Lawyer. Those that visited her observed a woman who enjoyed reading the newspaper and doing crossword puzzles with friends. When medical experts examined Carrie toward the end of her life, they found no evidence to suggest she was not of normal intelligence. Among some of her final recorded words, Carrie expressed forgiveness for those who had wronged her. "I tried helping everybody all my life, and I tried to be good to everybody. It just don't do no good to hold grudges." She died in 1983 at the age of 76. In a remarkable act of pure coincidence, Carrie was laid to rest mere feet away from her daughter Vivian at last reuniting a tortured mother with her long-lost child. The next article is titled, Vaccine Buses Are Helping Black and Brown Communities Get Vaccinated. This article is by Molly Hirsch and was published October 1st of 2021. On a Saturday morning in Harlem, bright pink buses stand out in stark contrast to the overcast day. A line forms, three people deep by noon. The New York City vaccination bus is open for business. The initiative began in April, part of Mayor Bill de Blasio's plan to increase vaccinations in the hardest-to-reach populations across the city. 6 months later, there is still progress to be made in Harlem, where the average fully vaccinated rate is 10% behind the city's 61% average. The gap highlights the remaining levels of vaccine hesitancy, both in my district and around New York City, says Representative Adriano Espaillat, a Democrat for New York, who represents Harlem. In order to overcome the pandemic, we need to understand why individuals are hesitant and more fully engage with them. To do that, pop-ups, vans, and buses have been stationed across all five boroughs, changing locations each weekend. On this particular weekend, the vaccine buses sit at the corner of West 152nd Street and Amsterdam Avenue from noon until 8 p.m., serving residents in West Harlem and Hamilton Heights. The security officer greets me in Spanish, then directs me to the clinic supervisor, who was dressed for comfort, neon orange vest over a tie-dye Bob Marley t-shirt, on what will prove to be a long day. A headband holds her locks out of her face while she works. She immediately runs a list of protocols for me. I'm not allowed on the bus. I can't interview or disturb the staff, but I am welcome to talk to patients as long as I don't disrupt the vaccine process. I'm told the vaccine buses serve between 100 to 300 people in a single day. No appointments are required. All a person needs to do is register. All a person needs to do to register is proof of age. Separate lines form behind two signs, one for Pfizer, another for Johnson & Johnson. People are handed wristbands based on the vaccine of their choice. Then they wait to board the medical bus, where healthcare workers in purple scrubs, many of whom are bilingual, administer the shots. The newly vaccinated are waved over to a second bus for observation, to check for any reactions and schedule their second dose. With no lines, the process can take under 30 minutes. Mohammed Al-Saidi, the 55-year-old owner of the nearby Savory Deli and Grocery, has made many trips to the bus to get his employees vaccinated. As of September 13th, the city has a vaccine mandate on indoor food businesses. If employees cannot provide proof of at least one dose, Al-Saidi could face over $5,000 in fines. Vaccines are also personal for Al-Saidi. He was one of the thousands of New Yorkers infected by the virus in April of 2020, at the peak of the first wave, and there were no available beds at his closest hospital. This was around the time the city ran out of space in morgues and turned to refrigerated trailers. Al-Saidi said he was sick for a month, and that a doctor advised him to drink plenty of fluids and stay home. He says he nearly died. Looking back at the past year, he cannot understand why people won't take advantage of the vaccine now that it's finally here. When I was sick, I'd give $100 to get vaccinated, he says. I'd give more than that. By 2:30 p.m., the line quiets down. Stepping off of the observation bus, Oscar Fabian Morales Reyes, age 40, shares that he flew all the way from Guatemala. Though more vaccine shipments finally arrived in his country, he says the government in Guatemala is not handling the situation very well. Reyes says that he felt safer getting it here. I don't trust my government. Reyes adds that he's shocked more people aren't clamoring for the vaccine given how accessible it is in New York. I think that should motivate people to get it, he says. But vaccinations were not always this accessible for Black and Brown communities. When free COVID-19 vaccinations first became available to New Yorkers in January, there were no vaccination sites north of 136th Street, leaving much of Upper Manhattan a vaccine desert, even though the area had some of the highest infection rates in the city. The mobile vaccination initiative was created to improve that access, traveling to neighborhoods with disproportionate cases of COVID-19 and histories of socioeconomic disparity identified by the city's Task Force of Racial Inclusion and Equity. Mobile vaccination clinics are one of the many ways New York City has met our residents where they are, Espelot says. And the success of this program can't be understated. Shoshana Barthley, 36, was nervous about getting the vaccine, but took it as a sign when the bus pulled up next to the park where she works as a park recreation specialist. "I felt like it came to me for real," she says. "I'm at work, and it came here, so I said, hey, why not? Why not today?" But Barthley wasn't sure about the vaccine and needed to ask some questions before finally deciding to get it. Who was the vaccine safe for? Why is it suddenly mandatory? Is the vaccine even effective if people are still getting sick? Why is the city paying people $100 to get something that is supposedly necessary? Like, tell us the truth, she says. Grasp our attention with the truth, not with an incentive. Less than an hour later, after the supervisor personally addressed her concerns, Barthley walks off the observation bus after getting her first Pfizer dose. Barthley's wariness is part of a larger history of mistrust between Black communities and the medical establishment. For centuries, African Americans were often the subjects of gross malpractice and cruel experimentation, as was the case with the infamous syphilis study conducted by Alabama's Tuskegee Institute on unsuspecting Black males. Even now, many Black Americans face medical discrimination, such as unequal pain treatment. Before vaccines were even rolled out, a December study from the Pew Research Center found that only 2 out of 5 African Americans intended to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Today, Black New Yorkers have the lowest vaccination rates of all ethnic groups in the city. It's no secret that our most underserved communities, particularly our lower income communities and communities of color, have been systemically ostracized, especially with regard to public health policy. Espelot says, it's incumbent on us to reconcile with this past, to rebuild trust, and to build back from this pandemic. By the time the line reopens, 11 people wait for walk-in service. 5 people with appointments get pulled off to the side, forming a third line. Ashley Milton, age 22, a labor and delivery nurse, says her job in the maternity ward puts her in a touchy position, working with expectant mothers who are nervous about getting the vaccine while pregnant. There is no proof that the vaccine can cause pregnancy or fertility issues, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention strongly encourage pregnant women to get the vaccine for their own protection. In the hospital, it's honestly rare that any of my patients are vaccinated, Milton says. I've been working there for 2 months now, and I probably had 2 patients who were vaccinated. And I see lots of patients. Milton didn't get one mother's positive test results until she was already pushing. I'm doing this to protect myself, Milton says. At 8 p.m., the tent goes down, and the vaccination bus closes for the day. I had arrived feeling skeptical, expecting there to be an absence of lines to match plateauing vaccination rates. Instead, I watched people decide this was the day to get the vaccine because it had come to them. The next article is titled, Free Community College is Possible If Senate Democrats Step Up. This op-ed urges Senate Democrats to seize the opportunity to make community college free. This article is by Max Lubin and Juveni Picant and was published September 21st of 2021. Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives recently advanced a proposal to make community colleges tuition-free nationwide. This bill would restore free community college in the City University of New York, CUNY, system, which had been free for more than 100 years. But unless Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer stands up for students, this proposal could be slashed by Republicans and moderate Democrats who are threatening to stop major new investments. Thanks to leaders like Dr. Jill Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders, who is a Democrat from Vermont, free community college has become a mainstream and very popular idea. The vast majority of Democrats in Congress support it, but our local elected officials in New York have been hostile. Both former Governor Andrew Cuomo and current Mayor Bill de Blasio sought funding cuts for the City University of New York, where Giovanni serves as a trustee and chair of the Student Senate. What makes those attacks on CUNY especially disappointing is that our colleges consistently rank in the top 10 schools that help students from low-income backgrounds rise into the middle class. Politicians that claim to be champions of working people have long threatened our city institutions that help us most. The history of free tuition at CUNY dates back to the school's founding in 1847. It lasted until 1976, when a fiscal crisis combined with racist blowback against college integration efforts paved the way for our modern tuition system. Black and brown students at CUNY fought for open admissions, but were overpowered by the systemic racism that spun out of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan's conservative revolution. As governor of California, Reagan vilified the UC system and slashed state funding for higher education. Speaking of the tuition and open enrollment policies, one of Nixon's education advisors cautioned, "We are in danger of producing an educated proletariat. This was the beginning of the end of free tuition systems in California and New York, and led to tuition spiraling out of control, even as CUNY students have struggled with food insecurity and homelessness. These problems exist nationwide. According to research conducted by the Hope Center for College, Community and Justice, nearly 3 in 5 students experienced basic needs insecurity during the fall of 2020, with especially high rates at community colleges. The current proposal in Congress would go a long way making sure students do not have to choose between their next meal and saving for tuition because it is a first dollar program. That means that the federal government would subsidize a student's tuition and allow them to keep their Pell Grant, which can be used to offset additional costs like books, housing, and transportation that are often more expensive than tuition itself. During the past year, Schumer has led calls for Biden to keep his promises by canceling student loan debt. Debt cancellation would be a huge step forward, but without enacting a college affordability agenda, future students and borrowers will just continue to accumulate more and more student loan debt. The main skeptics of free community college in the Senate are Republicans, who are stonewalling Biden's agenda, and a handful of Democrats. With razor-thin margins to pass a free community college bill, Senator Schumer will have to address their concerns and hold his caucus together. What policies are they worried about? While Senator Joe Manchin, Republican of West Virginia, voiced concerns that the House proposal does not have sufficient restrictions on students' income and overall spending. But the power of free community college programs is that they signal to students, often from low-income backgrounds, that there is a path for them to earn a degree. When programs add income caps, they muddle the message, and programs often go woefully underused. Even West Virginia Invest, the free community college tuition program in Manchin's home state of West Virginia, does not have income caps for participating students. It is also important to look at the insinuation that rich people would take advantage of these programs. The majority of community college students are working part or full-time students of color and receiving financial aid. The median income for full-time employees with an associate's degree is little over $46,000. These aren't exactly colleges for the 1%. The second concern, about spending, ignores that community colleges are a worthwhile investment that in the long run will grow our economy and funnel money back to the federal government. Otherwise, the economic and racial inequities in higher education prevent students from earning degrees that ultimately promote our nation's economic growth. Given the naysayers' frail logic, it seems like the decision on whether or not to make community colleges free will come down to politics over policy. Either way, we need Schumer to stand strong and keep the proposal for free community college intact and free from cuts. Through his position, the Senate Majority Leader can facilitate transformative change for students here in New York and nationwide. But if he caves to political pressure, he will be just another politician who made big promises to CUNY students that he could not deliver. And I'll read just a little bit of this next one. It's titled, Black Deaf Creators Are Pushing for Inclusivity Through TikTok Videos. Whether it be sewing enthusiasts, single parents, or neurodivergent individuals, TikTok offers a niche corner for everyone to revel in their shared experience. Deaf, hard of hearing, and sign language advocates are no exception to the platform, with Deaf TikTok, with hashtag Deaf TikTok garnering more than 840 million views on the app. September was Deaf Awareness Month, a time to celebrate the strides of those in the community and to educate both deaf and hearing people on sign language, deaf people's experiences, and the ingenuity of creators that have improved technology for the deaf community. On TikTok, Black Deaf creators are showing their own creativity and educating their followers, pushing for inclusivity and awareness from all, but especially from hearing users. One TikToker says, remember that deaf people are people. I think a lot of times when people look or sound different from us, we label them abnormal. If out in public, please take time to use your phone or a piece of paper to communicate back and forth if you don't know American Sign Language. 26-year-old Bree Jones is an ASL interpreter dedicated to teaching TikTok users about accessibility and historical deaf figures. She has nearly 30,000 followers on the platform, using her knowledge and advocacy to encourage others. All right, well, we have now run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.